Across My Family Line, written by Kay Burb and read by Flower Parrish.
And Kay Burb.
This is a Danny Phantom and Batman crossover fic, rated for teen and up audiences, in which no archive warnings apply. Summary. Is it that Tim Drake and Danny Fenton lead very different lives? Or is it that Tim Drake and Danny Fenton lead lives that mirror one another too closely? These are their stories, or at least how their stories began. Put it into words, how the holidays will always hurt. I watch the fathers with their little girls and wonder what I did to deserve this. How could you hurt a little? Chapter 1. I Have My Father's Eyes. Read by Flower Parrish. The Drakes were long rumored among the folk of Gotham to have something strange in their family tree. Magic, maybe. Royalty in the days of old, perhaps. It was even whispered that they had ties to murderers, whose urges followed through the generations, though that was the least commonly speculated theory of them all. It was all quite ridiculous. It was also, to varying extents, all quite true. Jack and Janet Drake despised these rumors. They were perfectly normal, thank you very much. Which was, in fact, deeply true. It often skipped a generation, this strangeness, sometimes a few. Timothy Drake had not been skipped, yet he didn't mind at all. In fact, he quite liked it. His parents did their best to discourage it. How dare he, or to them, she, exist as such? How dare he make it harder for their family to shine amongst the Gotham elite? Why couldn't they see how beautiful their history was? How revered they could be? Wasn't that, in the end, what they wanted? Tim had discovered the rumors purely by accident. His parents had tried to shelter him from them, but had made the simple error of sending him to a local private school, as opposed to somewhere far enough away that no one knew the Drake name. This meant that as the kids around him grew more aware of the inner workings of their high-class society, they began to treat Tim differently. The other girls were already wary of him and his boyish mannerisms, not becoming of a daughter in Gotham's high society. The boys didn't want to play with him. After all, he was wearing a uniform dress and his hair was plaited neatly each morning by Janet, and they simply could not have a girl on their team, no matter how much of a tomboy Tim viewed himself to be. Yet, no matter how hard Tim worked to be the perfect representation of girlhood, he never quite fit into the crowds of girls around him. It turned out, it wasn't just the way Tim carried himself that was off-putting for the other children. No, it was the rumors. The first time Tim asked about them, he was forced to sit down in his father's stuffy office and endure a lecture for the better part of an hour on the falsity of these rumors, on the normalcy of their family, on how they were better than those who would spread such lies, and how they only did so out of jealousy of all the Drakes had achieved. He knew better from then on than to let his parents know how odd the other children found him, how they seemed to believe in a magic he did not possess. Instead, Tim smiled and pretended to have friends, and eventually he was old enough, 8 to be precise, for his parents to leave him alone for long stretches while they traveled. He hated it, hated being alone so much, but it made the lies easier. He could ignore the phone when it rang, then call his parents back a few hours later, claiming to have been over at a schoolmate's house. Tim spent his time teaching himself to skateboard down the halls of the large, empty home, or researching the dig sites his parents were visiting, to understand what drew them away from him so often. As the years passed, the phone calls lessened. The rare occasions they were home, the loneliness had been replaced by an aching sense that things were far easier when they weren't. Tim Tim discovers how his bloodline sings within him purely by accident. He's 12 and suffocating in a ruffled dress, hovering at the edge of a gala at Wayne Manor. He knows his parents will be looking for him to be mingling, a dutiful daughter putting her best foot forward to represent the Drake name. He tugs at the high neck of his dress, wishing he was anywhere else. Anyone else. Tim's eyes land on the newest Wayne ward, Jason Todd, a kid from Crime Alley who's two grades ahead of him at school. Tim envies him. He looks free. On edge, sure, as uncomfortable as Tim is in this crowd, though likely for different reasons. Yet, still, there is a freedom to him that Tim is unable to possess. Like he was born in the right body, a small voice says in the back of Tim's mind. He shoves that thought down. Or, well, he tries to, but it rises again, unbidden. The right body. Tim is suddenly so, so aware of how wrong his changing body feels. He tugs again at the pink monstrosity engulfing him, realizes how desperately he wants out, not just out of the gala, but out of this dress, out of this body. The want, the need, overtakes him. Out, out, out! Tim gasps for air as panic washes over him until, suddenly, the panic becomes a physical thing. His body is aching, feeling stretched and pulled, as though an invisible sculptor is working on the very clay of his existence and forcing his structure to remold. Tim stumbles out of the room into the shadows of the hallway. The dress had been suffocating before, but now it's tight in all the wrong places. His shoulders are pressing against the fabric. He's worried if he breathes in too deeply, it will rip. He grasps desperately at the fabric, feeling his muscles ripple under his hands before they tighten and seem to settle into place. Tim has had panic attacks before, but this physicality is new. Trying locked door after locked door until he finds one that opens. Tim falls into the room, slamming the door closed, and slumps against it, attempts to steady himself. After a few minutes, not hours, because his parents would have found him by now, right? Tim manages to calm down enough to lift his head from his knees, lock the door, and fumble for a light switch. He's found himself in a bathroom, by some stroke of luck, and he moves with shaky legs over to the sink. He reaches for the faucet to splash water on his face, and his fingernails are shorter, jagged. He thinks of the expression, like the back of my hand, the idea of it being the most familiar thing people can think of, and, well, this is not the back of his hand. Tim grips the edge of the sink. Inhale. Exhale. He looks up. The face staring back at him is not his own, save for his eyes. Jack Drake's eyes stare back at him from this foreign face. But it's not wholly unfamiliar either. There's markers there of the Todd boy, and he hadn't meant to do this. Had he done this? How? Tim splashes water on his face, scrubs at his eyes, and tries to keep the bile rising in his throat down. But when he looks back up, his face is still wrong. Except, says that voice in his head again, it doesn't feel all wrong, does it? There's a knock on the door, but Tim worries that, if he opens his mouth, he might throw up. He breathes through his nose, eyes screwed shut, and prays that when he opens them again, he will find his own face staring back at him in the mirror. Another knock, less patient this time. Just a minute, Tim manages, and is relieved to hear his own voice, high-pitched and feminine, like it should be. He is Miss Drake. He is a daughter. He is not the boy in the reflection. Pain again, and his arms shake, though it is less this time. It does not last as long this time, and, while he is dizzy again, he feels centered once more. The dress hangs off his body as it is supposed to, hugging his burgeoning curves. When his eyes blink open again, he finds thin fingers with chipped nail polish now grip the sink. His fingers, the back of a hand he does know. He is in the body his parents expect to see again. Slowly, he moves to the door, unlocking it. The person on the other side is tapping her heeled foot impatiently, and Tim gives her a polite nod, dipping forward in a slight curtsy as is expected. He mumbles his apology before sliding around her, taking up as little space as possible, and heading back to the gala. The moment he enters the Wayne's ballroom, he can feel his parents' eyes on him, expectant. So, he does the one thing that might make them happy and walks up to the newest Wayne boy. "Jason Todd, right?" Tim says brightly, sticking out a hand to shake. "Drake, well, that's my last name. I'm Mist..." Tim doesn't know he's Tim for 4 more years. 4 years of exploring this legacy, researching his family line, of listening to the way the world around him sings. Each transformation hurts less and less until it's a natural thing. Tim becomes different people and learns to control the shifts, how to direct his hair length, its color, how to stretch his muscles to the height he needs. Eventually, it doesn't feel so much like a transformation. It's like changing his clothes, stepping from one outfit to another. The one thing that never seems to shift are his eyes. His father's eyes, always staring back at him, set in new faces each time. He'll always have Jack Drake's eyes. Tim doesn't know why that is. He learns how to hack. Tim still doesn't have friends, except for Jason, who excitedly learns to hack alongside him. In doing so, he is able to access records his great-grandfather had locked away, determined to make a name for the Drake family in Gotham. Discovers their history. Discovers the Fae. He realizes this is what he was born to do. This is who he is, who he was meant to be. Not just the powers, the magic in his blood, but Tim. Not a daughter, but a son. Not a girl, but a boy. Not a socialite, but a Robin. Jason dies when the second Robin disappears, and Tim knows what it means. He's known for years, from the moment Dick Grayson put on the costume and stepped out by the side of the Dark Knight. Well, Tim was a little young to know for sure, but he also cannot remember the moment he realized, so he'll hold that he's always known. Jason was his friend. He saw Tim for who he was. Not the changeling, but the boy. Tim thought that maybe, one day, he'd tell Jason about his family's secret. But it had been useful for following Batman and Robin nightly, always as a different person, never as himself. He attends the funeral as himself, that is, as the daughter representing the Drake family. Jack and Janet did not return home. They had no interest in attending the funeral of a former street rat. Not that they were improper enough to say so, but it was in the subtext of their disinterest. It didn't matter that this was their daughter's best friend, that perhaps Tim needed the support. So he stands, alone, by Jason's grave and allows his tears to fall, until he feels someone settle next to him. He looks up, sees Dick Grayson, face ashen and anger in his eyes. Tim wonders who that anger is directed towards. Jason, for dying, or Batman, for allowing it. They stand together, silently, until Dick clasps Tim's shoulder. "Thank you," he whispers, and Tim cocks his head in confusion. "For being there for him, when I failed to be." "I couldn't save him," Tim says, and his voice cracks. "You couldn't have," is Dick's response, and something dark flashes in his eyes. He shakes his head. "Anyway, I gotta go, but again, thank you." Tim watches Dick walk away before leaning down and placing a small Robin stuffed animal on Jason's grave. "Goodbye," he whispers, tracing over the name on the headstone. As he leaves, it begins to rain. Tim takes time to heal until he sees Mr. Wayne's grief nearly destroy him. It finally shakes Tim from his own mourning. "Let me be your Robin," he insists. Batman tries to argue, pushes against it. So, Tim does the only thing he can think of. He changes in front of him, becoming him. "Let me help you," he insists. And Bruce relents. "You have to train," he tells him, "6 months minimum, and take orders too, or this won't work. I won't lose another Robin." "Whatever you want from me," Tim promises. He will regret that eventually, but he doesn't know that yet.
Chapter 2, I'm Telling Lies, A Million to Survive, read by K-Burb.
But I truly am my parents' child. Scattered across my family line, I'm so good at telling lies. That came from my mother's side, told a million to survive.
The problem with being half-ghost, half-human, wasn't really any of the strange side effects that came with it. Not for Danny, at least. The problem was his family. The problem was that, before he died, Danny was terrible at telling lies. And now, he was the very thing his parents hated. It turns out, under duress, Danny could lie pretty skillfully. The thing is, Danny's parents really aren't that bad. Offbeat, certainly, much to Jazz's dismay. She longed for normalcy, and for just a little family therapy. Danny found that he thrived in the chaos. He knows his parents aren't inherently horrible people. They love him, and Jazz, and show it in whatever ways they can, even if they often fall short. Sure, they could be neglectful, but they were geniuses. Wasn't that how all genius parents were? Caught up in their work, drawn into their own wild theories, a bit blind to the needs of those around them? They may have caused yet unknown layers of trauma with their antics. They may have tried to force him to hunt ghosts, told him being an astronaut was a frivolous dream, but still, when the scales are balanced, the outcome is always the same. They're good to him in the ways he needs most of all. They don't force him into frills and dresses when he's little, and when he tells them he's their son, they never once question it. "Biology never said there were only two sexes, honey," Maddie Fenton says brightly. Jack Fenton clasps his shoulder. "We always knew you were special, son." And Danny's heart swells. They help him get on blockers when puberty starts, and when his body changes too much for comfort, they sign off on surgery to help him love the body he's in. He knows how lucky he is for this support, these ways they show love. It's just that there's nothing they hate more than ghosts. He's not sure if they love him enough to set that part of themselves aside. Danny keeps it a secret for years, often by sheer luck alone. His lies are terrible at first, yet they don't seem to suspect him. Maybe they're blinded by their love. Yet, this does not excuse the amount of times they point fingers at Jazz. Maybe they're simply too caught up in their own assumptions about ghosts, about their son. Maybe they're only pointing fingers at Jazz because they know how out of left field such accusations are. Maybe they don't truly want one of their children to be one of the very beings they swore to destroy. He gets better at lying. It turns out Jazz was never fooled, just good at pretending she was oblivious to the truth. Danny loves her for that. For a long time, too long. Danny just viewed her as his overbearing big sister. She was always too much, too present, too controlling. He understands now that she was just trying, desperately, to keep him safe, to fill in the gaps that their parents left. Jazz parentified herself, in a way, and Danny hates that she sacrificed her own childhood for his, only for him to go and get involved in the very thing she'd sacrificed her peace of mind to keep him away from. It's undeniable that things are easier when his sister can shoulder this burden with him in their home. Sam and Tucker do their best, but they don't know what it's like to live in the Fenton home, human or otherwise. The act of lying gets easier, yes, but it's never once ideal, especially as he's able to hide less and less. Phantom becomes an enemy in his parents' eyes. He falls into a relationship, and everything about what he has with Valerie is built on these lies, this deceit. She hates half of him. She says so to his face, not knowing she's talking to Danny. They break up. It isn't easy. Even as his town begins to view him as a hero, even as he becomes a king, there's still three people who will never accept him for who he is. Funny, isn't it? His parents could deal with losing their daughter when so many other parents would have turned him away at that. But they would view his ghost half as a betrayal. Wouldn't they? Danny's parents find out he's half ghost the first time, and he realizes just how much they love him. It makes handling their hatred of ghosts markedly easier, though not their hatred of Phantom. Wiping their memories of this moment, making himself unknown to them once more, is one of the hardest things he's ever had to do. Danny's regret nearly destroys him. He knows it's for the best. The second time they find out, there's no going back. Danny has, against all odds, saved the world. Not alone, never alone. He has his friends and, inexplicably, his enemies to thank for his success. His sister, too. Not Jazz, though, yes, she plays a large part in everything Danny has accomplished. But Danny. Danny was a surprise. An enemy, at first. A tool of Vlad's, the first of Jack Fenton's ghostly disasters. She terrifies him. "Breathe, Danny," Jazz tells him, cupping his face in her hands. He looks up at her, vision blurred by tears. "Dysphoria," is all he manages, voice shaking. She pulls him close and hums an old lullaby, one that calls forward memories of safety. "She's not you," Jazz reminds him. "But she is," the traitorous voice in his head says. "She's not," Jazz says. Did Danny say that out loud? "She's your DNA," Jazz continues, and she sounds so much like their mother in this moment. "But she isn't you, Danny. Vlad wanted a son, but he couldn't replicate you. Danny is a clone of who you would have been if our parents didn't love you. If you didn't know who you truly are and fight to fix your situation, yeah?" "Yeah," he whispers back, nodding as he wipes his tears. "Danny, what's important now," she reminds him, "is that you show her the way." And he does. Which brings him to the present, to the moment his parents see him for who he is, And this time, he won't be reversing it. His secret is out now. He has no choice but to move forward. He finds that, this time, he doesn't want to go back. Danny Fenton is Danny Phantom. The Phantom. The Ghost King. He's half ghost, but he's fully his parents' son. They accept him. They love him. He sneaks off, away from this moment he'd always wanted, to pursue something else he's been wishing for. He kisses Sam. They don't last. That isn't a bad thing. Sam is his best friend. Nothing that happens in this lifetime, or any others, has ever been able to change that. Danny would know. He's seen many parallel timelines ever since becoming half-ghost. They're laying together, on the floor of Danny's childhood bedroom, shoulders touching. The stars he'd glued on his ceiling have long since lost their glow, but he remembers when he'd first put them up. Sam was here then, too, climbing precariously on furniture with him. They were 10 and hiding away from Tucker. It was one of those rare times he'd taken her side. He should have taken her side more. Back then, they hadn't known what the future had in store for them. Ghosts were a silly thing his parents fixated on, and there was nothing but childhood joy between them. Sam hadn't held his hand as he woke up from surgery. He hadn't held back her hair the first time she drank too much at a party, and they had never once even dreamed of kissing one another. Now, there is a tension in the air that Danny can't cut through, and he can't quite put his finger on why. Maybe it's just that this will be the first time since second grade they'd spent significant time apart. Or maybe it's the fear that this can't last. Danny, Sam whispers. He feels her shift and turns his head to look at her, meeting her eyes. There's tears forming, yet she doesn't look sad. He knows Sam's moods, her expressions. There's no sorrow there, just a sort of wistfulness. Yeah, Danny whispers back. I think, she pauses, takes a breath. I think we should break up. Danny wants to protest, wants to feign surprise. But he gave up on lying 2 years ago, and there's no point. She knows him as well as he knows her. This was coming to an end, wasn't it? He sees that now. One of them just had to speak it first. I know, he says, and his voice doesn't waver. There's a certainty to it. Sam smiles, a small thing, but it still eases something in his chest. We'll be okay, right? Danny can't help but ask. Always, she assures. She leans forward, resting her forehead on his. A final kiss, the perfect bittersweet ending to them. They will no longer be a we, not romantically, but they are still Sam and Danny. And Tucker, too. They always have been. Always will be. Danny will always love her. She will always love him. The love had changed, briefly, but now they were back to the beginning. As it should be. The drive to Gotham is a long one, but Jazz is with him. He's in the front seat of her car, with Tucker and Danny in the back, sharing an old iPod of Danny's that Danny had dug up while he was packing. The trunk is packed with odds and ends Jazz had picked up on her short trip home. His parents drive the moving truck, filled with his and Tucker's things. Gotham is perfectly situated between New York, where Jazz is in her third year of pre-med at Columbia, and Delaware, where Tucker will be attending his dream university, the Metropolis Institute of Technology. They'll drop Tucker off first at MIT, then head north to drop off Danny and Jazz at their respective schools. Danny, biologically 2 years younger, will return to Amity Park. She won't be alone, though. Sam's attending art school in Chicago and has promised to check in on her regularly. "You're sure about this?" Jazz asks quietly, glancing over to him as they cross the border into Delaware. One stop, then New Jersey. Danny gives her what he hopes is a reassuring smile. "Sure as can be," he promises. "You've got everything you need." He rolls his eyes and she huffs. "Yes, Mom," he teases. "I just worry, I know. But I thought you learned a while ago not to." "Danny, you're my baby brother," she says. "I will always worry about you." He knows what she means. It's how he is with Danny. How he is with Jazz, despite her being older. With Sam. With Tucker. Protective. "It's natural to worry about the people you love," Danny says from the back. He hadn't realized she'd been listening. They lock eyes in the rearview mirror, blue meeting blue. She smiles, and her eyes flash green, for just a moment. A reminder of what will always connect them. "Run through the list one more time," Jazz insists. "Which one?" Tucker quips, pulling up his PDA, an outdated piece of tech he's fought hard to keep modern. "The list of Gotham vigilantes, the list of emergency contacts, the list of school supplies, the list of portals to..." "Oh my God, Tucker," Jazz groans. "Annoying when it's turned back on you, isn't it?" Danny says. Jazz's turn to roll her eyes. He loves their summers together, even though they've shortened as Jazz's studies intensified. They'll be closer in distance now that they're both in college on the East Coast. But the distance from Sam is going to be an adjustment, especially with the way things have changed between them. And being away from Danny, despite how comparatively short their time has been together, is going to be difficult. But Danny has fought ghosts. He has saved the world. He has fallen in and out of love. He was turned half-ghost. He took in his own clone. And he has been openly true to himself, despite the odds. He can handle freshman year of college. The end. I'm so good at telling lies. That came from my mother's side. Told a million to survive. Scattered across my family line. God, I have my father's eyes. But my sister's when I cry. I can run, but I can't hide from my family line. From my family line.